Recording has started.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms and All GTLDs, our PDP Working Group call on the 8th of August, 2018. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call, as we have quite a few participants online. Attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you happen to be only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all participants also to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and if you would please keep your phones and microphones on mute as well when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will hand the meeting back over to Julie Hedlund. Please begin.
Thanks so much, Michelle. This is Julie Hedlund from staff, and the co-chairs of the working group, Kathy Kleiman, Phil Corwin, and Brian Beckham, asked staff to take the lead on walking us through the document today, which is our main agenda item for the call. Perhaps before we move to that, we could do the usual review of the agenda and also ask if there are updates to the statements of interest. And I see George has his hand up. Please, George, go ahead.
George Krikos for the transcript. Yeah, I just want to advise that I have an updated statement of interest. I'm now a member of the at-large. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for the update, George. We appreciate that. And we've just noted that in the notes. Anybody else have any updates to their statements of interest? And I see George has put that updated SOI in the chat. Thank you, George. I'm looking for hands. I'm not seeing any, so someone on audio, please go ahead. Is that someone trying to speak? I'm not hearing that again. And if it is somebody who's just on audio, and if we can't hear you, it sounded a little bit rough. Then you can always type into the chat. Just again to review the agenda, thank you for the updates and statements of interest. The main item we'll be discussing today is the introduction to the consolidated URS topics table with findings, issues, and suggestions from all three URS subteams for the working group discussion. And there'll also be a discussion on that. And then we will have any other business. And let me ask at this point if we have any other business. And George, please.
George Krikos here. Just to be clear, this table isn't the final word on the URS topic. I'm assuming we can add various other topics accordingly because there are things that are obviously not on that table. For example, a limitation period for bringing a URS, the elephant in the room, whether it should be a consensus policy applicable to older legacy GTLDs, and things like that. I don't want to list them all, but there are obviously other topics that should be discussed. So whether we do that today or at some future point, that's up to the co-chairs, but it should be done at some point. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And I'll let the co-chairs chime in if they should wish, but staff, and I see Brian's got his hand up, but the staff will note, and Brian perhaps may address this as well, that these topics were developed by the working group members quite some time ago, many months ago, and they have been deliberated on at the working group level and also on the with the sub-team on URS documents. If there is something that's missing, if the work group feels something that needs to be added or is wrong, certainly we can do that. But just to note, these have been out there for quite some time. But let me go to Brian, please. And Brian, if you're trying to speak, we are hearing some static. I don't know if that is from you, but we did not hear you, if you would like to try again. Again, Brian, apologies. We could not hear you. Phil, I see your hand is up. Please, Phil.
Yeah, I just wanted to make clear that the document we have is a consolidated summary of the findings and recommendations of the subteams. If anyone was on a subteam and thinks anything is missing, we can, you know, we're happy to have that input. And the table is by no means meant to limit recommendations for administrative, operational, or policy change of the URS when we open up the floor later this month to get to the decisional phase on the URS. So it is what it is, but it's not meant to limit the ability of working group members to propose other operational, administrative, or policy changes to the URS. And as previously discussed within the working group, under our charter, we have flexibility that if an issue is determined to be intertwined with a UDRP issue or simply does not have consensus for change at this point, it can be carried over to phase two of our work. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And I see Brian again. We'll give you another try, Brian, and see if we can hear you. Thank you. Brian, I think we hear you, but you seem to have been very faint. Could you try again, please?
Is this any better?
A little bit.
Maybe I'll just try it if it doesn't.
We can hear you now, Brian. Please go ahead.
Good. So I hope this complements what Phil said, just to George's question about
You are fading in and out, unfortunately, Brian. Now you Yes, if you could type it in the chat, that'd be quite helpful. And if you'd like, I'm sure the operator would be happy to dial out to you if that would be better. And just let us know if that would work, and we can certainly dial out to you.
Thanks.
Thank you. So since we have already embarked on the discussion of the consolidated URS topics table, then staff will go ahead and kick off the discussion, and this may also address some of the questions that have been raised already thus far. So you will see the document in front of you in the Adobe Connect room, and we have also sent it around yesterday or very early this morning for those in the APAC region. And we are actually calling this a super consolidated URS topics table because it actually builds on the consolidated URS topics table that the URS subteam on documents has been discussing for a great deal of time, many months. This table actually pulls together, and as Kathy notes, all of the, and Phil as well, all of the work of the three URS subteams. Just a reminder, the three URS subteams were the subteam on practitioners, providers, and related documents. And so this format is actually the format that the URS document subteam has been working with for many months. The difference with the super consolidated table is that the findings, recommendations, draft recommendations, and suggested operational fixes from each of the three subteams are consolidated into this one table. So, yes, as Kathy notes, this really is a summary of where we are thus far. So let me just go a little bit into the introduction of the document and just to remind everybody that the approved charter for the RPM working group, as you may recall, included a series of unfiltered and overlapping and sometimes unclear questions And the working group has set out to refine those questions and to produce relevant policy recommendations and to identify areas where specific feedback from the community would be useful. And so, to do this, the working group originally decided on several high-level questions, as you see here, to be used as a framework for evaluating and developing policy suggestions for the ERS dispute resolution process, but noting that these questions may not be applicable in each situation. And just as a reminder, these are: how has the ERS been used, why or why not, what was the original purpose? How is it being fulfilled? Bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? What changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose, facilitate it to carry out its purpose, and what was the ultimate outcome? And as noted previously already on this call, the working group agreed to this initial consolidated URS topics table, which includes the suggested URS review topics, also the original charter questions, and suggested refined new questions and data sources. And by this table, I mean the consolidated URS topics table that then became the framework of the work of the URS documents subteam. So then, as you again also may recall, the working group established the three URS subteams already mentioned to identify sources for related documents and to analyze those sources. And so, as you also may know, the URS providers developed a series of questions. Provider subteam developed a series of questions for URS providers. Those questions have been answered, and there are some further questions that just went out earlier this week. And the URS practitioner subteam developed a survey and has analyzed the responses to the survey, and that analysis from these subteams, actually the three subteams, was provided in presentation form at last week's call on the 1st of August. So, where we stand now. This document synthesizes the work of the three subteams' preliminary findings, issues, proposed suggestions, and its data sources. It is organized according to the topics, the URS review topics, that were in the initial consolidated URS topics table. So this is, again, as noted in the chat, this is a list of topics that the working group agreed to after significant discussion, and these are the list of topics that have been carried on by the URS document subteam. And the hope is that this document will facilitate the working group discussions concerning similar complementary URS finding suggestions as well as differences, and including whether and what scope type of guidance should be developed to improve the ERS and what open questions on which community feedback should be sought. But as already noted by Phil, and I think Brian and Kathy as well, the co-chairs note that neither is the working group bound to take the proposed suggestions, nor do the proposed suggestions restrict the scope of what the working group will consider as it prepares the draft initial report. And then you'll see some links there to the wikis for the three subteams so that you can see how their work progressed. And then again, just noted, as of the 7th of August, the provider subteam is waiting for responses to follow-up questions. And these are actually noted as action items in this document. So I'm going to stop there and see if there are any questions. And I'm noting that we have quite a bit going on in the chat. I'm not going to try to read the whole chat because the chat obviously will be made available to all of you, and it's also going to be posted on the wiki. But just a few things to note. There's a question about whether or not, from George, whether or not topics are missing. As we noted, these were the topics that the working group agreed to, but if there are missing topics, please do let us know. I will note that that Brian is saying the chart is not meant to foreclose further discussion and is a good faith attempt at capturing the work of the sub-teams. The purpose of today's and likely the next few calls is to make sure this is an accurate and comprehensive reflection of our discussion so far. But that said, working group members should bear in mind that we are seeking consensus, so items which are unlikely to achieve that may not be appropriate to reflect as a recommendation, but could be included in public comments in the initial report. Also, before adding items to this chart, we will want to work with staff to see whether such topics were previously discussed, and if so, the level of agreement consensus. In other words, it's not necessarily final, but is equally an opportunity to reintroduce topics which have been discussed, but for which consensus was not possible. So that's Brian's reply. And then we have some other comments. With respect to your comments, George, there is also a topic at the end of the document about alternative processes, but may not be the same thing. I'm going to ask if we have any comments on the introduction to this document. Questions, comments? I'm looking for hands. Not seeing any hands. So, how the co-chairs are proposing to proceed is that we will walk through this document from the beginning, and according to the layout that we have here, which is by topics, the topics agreed to by the working group. And in particular, we're going to focus on the proposed suggestions, which includes draft recommendations, it includes suggested operational fixes, and also some action items. And just again, to note the structure, you have the topic. The topics are arranged in order of sequentially in order of how the URS is used, and then we have the preliminary finding or issue as determined by the various subgroups, subteams. So these are labeled by subteam, some of which arise from responses from providers, some from the practitioner survey, and some from the work of the document subteam. Then there's the proposed suggestions, and then the final column is the source of the information. So the source would be then, say, survey results, again, responses from providers, practitioners, or also some of the data analysis conducted by the document subteam, such as from the review of cases from Rebecca Teschert's coding and so forth. And those documents also are available, those that are referenced there as data sources are also available on the wiki. So, starting from the beginning, the complaint. And please at any time do raise your hand and let us know if you want staff to stop, if you have a question, and we'll pause. Okay. So under the complaint, standing to file, a standing and a suggestion to consider expanding standing to allow marks that were abusively registered but are not confusingly similar. So from the document subteam, there was no data or feedback to support this suggestion, so the draft recommendation is that there's no additional policy work required, and then you can also see the link to the related practitioner survey results. And staff will just, I'll just keep moving along unless I see a hand up. So again, as we're moving along, if you have any questions, please put up your hand. And I'm seeing there's continued chat, but I'm not sure that that is relating to where we are right now in this document. If there are issues to raise when we get to that point in the document, please do raise them. And noting that if there are some issues raised in this call that are missing, we can capture them. Obviously, we do capture the chat. We can capture them in the notes as well. So moving along, grounds for filing. Grounds, specifically types of marks on which a complaint may be based. Document subteam, no data feedback indicating that this is a URS problem. Draft recommendation, again from the document subteam, no additional policy work on URS required. Questions about quote-unquote types of marks seem to be part of the TMCH and, in particular, claims notices review. The data source is Rebecca Tushnet's coding, as you see there. Yes, and the document is unsynced, so you may move it yourself. And we are on the first page at this point. I'm looking for hands and not seeing any. Moving along, limited filing period, number 3. From the practitioner subteam, the subteam did not comment on the survey results with respect to the response period or time frames connected to complaint filings, but see section C below. There are no proposed suggestions. The reference to practitioner survey results and the provider's feedback. And George, please.
Yeah, George Krikos for the transcript. For this limited filing period, there should be some discussion about having a limitation period of, say, 2 years or so to bring a URS complaint. Otherwise, we could have URS complaints filed for domains that are registered 15 or 20 years, which would be relatively unfair to the registrant. At some point, you know, they need to move beyond some of these kind of small claims court procedures and move to the real courts. And so there should be a specific limitations period applied to these RPMs, especially the URS, given its lack of due process. Thank you.
Thank you, George. So let me just ask if the subteam leaders have any response to that, because what this document does is brings forward the data that has been collected from the three subteams, so documents from providers and from practitioners. And I'll just note that Brian notes that this was discussed but did not achieve agreement. George notes the subteams aren't the entire working group. And Kathy, you have your hand up. Please go ahead, Kathy.
Hi, Julie. This is Kathy. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Terrific. And Julie, thank you, and thank all of staff, Ariel, Mary, Barry, for the incredible work that went into, I think this is a 36-page document, and the consolidations. So I appreciate the process that you're going through to walk us through, and that everyone's going through from the perspective of their subteams, for those who are members of the subteam, to see if we captured this. Is this, you know, if it's not in this document, actually, as George pointed out, if it's not in this document, it's going to be hard for us to see it going forward. This is the summary here. So, you know, if you're seeing something that's missing, whether it's a draft recommendation, an open question, an operational fix, an action item that you remember from the subteam, you know, please help us. There are a lot of eyes have gone into this document, but we need more, and that's why we're reviewing it. To Mary, to the suggestion that I made, I guess to staff generally, an open, can we have that, you know, it. Does anyone object, both co-chair staff and members of the working group, does anyone object to creating a list of as yet unaddressed items? So one thing that most of the subteams looked backwards, right? We looked at what's been done already. So clearly a statute of limitations or a latches concept in the URS doesn't exist yet, as it doesn't in the UDRP. There is discussion about it. There are articles about it, but it doesn't exist yet. So I think it is something to hold on to and come back to. And after we've looked at the past, as we're considering the present and especially the future, that's a concept to hang on to. So I think George raises a good point. There are others in this working group who have raised this issue recently, actually, in other forums. So I like the idea of putting it on a list of what's of issues to look at once we've looked at the data to date. So it's a policy issue. So if we could keep that list, unless anybody objects, I would support that. It gives us kind of a checklist to go to of what's likely to be more policy issues, policy revisions, whereas now we're working on operational fixes as well as policy recommendations kind of directly arising. Sorry, long comment. Let me turn it back. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you, Kathy. And Phil Corwin, please.
Yeah, thank you. Speaking for myself here, as I said before, well, this is as a co-chair, this list is a summary of the findings and recommendations of the subteams, which focus primarily on whether the URS is operating in conformity, is being administered in conformity with the current policy, and whether any significant problems have been identified by providers and practitioners. It does not foreclose any ability of any working group member to propose other proposed changes in URS operation, administration, or basic policy when we open up the floor for that in a few weeks. Now, speaking personally on the issue of latches, there's no wonder that it didn't come up in this review of the URS, since all the new TLDs are new and virtually all URS cases were filed within a few months of the registration of the domain in question. So no one, it's not surprising that it wasn't an issue in the exercise of the subteams. If any member of the working group thinks that's a policy change that's worthwhile, they can propose it when we open the floor, make their case, and we can see if there's any substantial support for it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Phil. Appreciate it. And I see Mary, you have your hand up. Mary Wong, please.
Thank you, Julie and everyone. This is Mary from staff, and I did type a few comments in the chat, but for the benefit of those on the phone and for the record, in answer to Kathy's question, certainly staff will be happy to keep a list of any missing issues we may have inadvertently omitted from the record. What I think will be helpful for the group, especially those that have not been following subteams' work or looking at their reports, is that as far as we know, those specific issues that have been listed so far on this call were indeed discussed within at least one of the subteams and reported back to the working group. And so what we've done in this document on page 2 is provided a link to all three subteams and all their reports and documents. You'll recall also that each subteam reported back to the working group at least a couple of times, and finally last week. So, again, we're happy to keep a list of missing issues, but we really want to encourage working group members not to reopen issues that have been closed or to raise issues that have been reported as missing issues if there's no consensus to reopen those discussions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mary. So we'll go ahead and proceed to item 4, administrative review. And so here we have the document subteam noting feedback from providers does not seem to indicate need for additional policy work. We have the provider subteam, ADN-DRC accepts complaints that do not contain all the, and here we're crossing over the page here, all the elements required in URS Rule 3. Providers rely heavily on information provided by the parties and are unable to search or track information, at least in several jurisdictions, about active court cases relating to the URS proceedings. And then draft recommendation, document subteam, no additional policy work required. Suggested operational fix, provider subteam, since at least one provider appears to accept complaints that do not contain all the elements in Rule 3B, even before GDPR came into effect, working group to consider how ICANN should enforce compliance with the URS procedures and rules, including URS Rule 3B and URS procedures and rules generally. And then we have an action item, subteam to ask ADN DRC to explain why they accept complaints that do not contain all the elements required in URS Rule 3B, subteam to ask details from ADN DRC and forum on their administrative check to determine whether a domain name is already subject to an open and active URS UDRP proceeding or court cases. And staff will note that these two action items, these questions, have gone out as follow-on questions to the providers as of this Monday, and responses are requested by the 20th of August. And Kathy, you had your hand up, but now it seems to have disappeared.
No, I think it's still up, at least it appeared. You're right, it suddenly went down. I'd like to keep it up, if I might. Here's the question, Julian. It's a procedural one, and I raise it. I think I know the answer, but I think we should discuss it, which is when there's an action item, are the subteams still meeting? When the providers get back to the additional questions that were raised by the provider subteam, procedurally, will the provider subteam meet again, or will that data come straight back to the working group? At this point, we kind of have to decide where things are going.
Thank you, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff, and that's a very good question. So staff suggests that the provider's subteam would like to meet to first have the opportunity to go over these follow-on responses from the providers. And then once they've had a chance to analyze the responses, then they would do as they've done with the other responses and prepare their input for the full working group to consider. And I see that George Kirikos has his hand up. George, please.
Yeah, with regards to George Kirikos for the transcript, on page 4 it says work group to consider how ICANN should enforce compliance with the URS procedure and rules. And so I think one of the issues is that ICANN has currently done what's called a credit and forget it for the URS providers. And so I think we need to go further and bring the URS providers under contract with specific penalties for noncompliance, because right now the enforcement mechanisms really don't exist per se, because how can they actually enforce these requirements when there's no contract specifying the terms. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And I see a couple of other hands here. I have Maxime Elzoba and then Phil Corwin, please. Maxime?
Maxime Elzoba, for the record. I'm not sure that ICANN compliance can talk to any other party than registries and registrars, and maybe to potential complainant. That's it. They are not the party enforcing ICANN contracts with URS providers. Most probably it's going to be legal department. Just notice. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxim. And Phil, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to note for the record that the URS providers are under a rudimentary contract. They're under a memorandum of understanding that's uniform that all three entered into with ICANN. I was one of the advocates for that contractual relationship at the time the URS was being developed. And whether it's compliance department or legal, I would hope it's not controversial that providers should accord to the policy and shouldn't be able to ignore portions of the policy that they find for some reason they don't wish to comply with. So, but we'll get to that in our when we complete our review of this document and open up the decisional phase. The recommendations will all be considered by the full working group, and we can discuss see if there's consensus support. I would hope on something like that, that there is, and what the best way to bring those providers into line with the policy would be. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And unless there are further questions on item 4, staff will continue to item 5. And item 5 is the 500-word complaint limit. Practitioner subteam noted that some thought the word limit of 500 words was too low, quote-unquote, quote, arbitrary and often insufficient, and, quote-unquote, should be slightly increased, were two responses. The provider subteam provider's feedback confirms that some practitioners have raised issues with the word limit. However, providers generally believe that the balance of the word limits for both complaint and response is reasonable. If complaint word limit is increased, should response limit be correspondingly increased? If so, need to consider impact on examiners. And the document subteam, based on practitioner survey results, no additional policy work is required. Under the draft recommendation, of the three subteams, this is an area on which views will differ, and the overall purpose of the URS as a lighter complement to the UDRP needs to be kept in mind, and no policy recommendation at this time. And Michael, please. Michael Graham, Michael, please, and then Phil.
Okay, Michael Graham for the record. Thank you. I had a question because I'm not going back and forth, and that was whether or not, as part of this discussion, and this, I guess, is to the working groups, whether or not part of the discussion was whether or not, rather than expanding the word limit, having an express ability to for either of the parties to request leave for filing an expanded brief. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. And I'd like to ask if the three sub-team chairs have any comment on Michael's question. I don't think that this was encompassed in any of the questions to the practitioners in the practitioner survey. I'm not sure about the providers, and I'm not sure if the document subteam considered this as well. Michael's asking, Brian's asking if you could repeat the question. Michael, could I ask you to repeat the question? And then, and I saw that Jason's hand was up.
Yeah, it's Michael Graham. The question was, in discussing this, where it was determined that there's no recommendation, whether or not there was a discussion of whether, rather than expanding the word limit of having an express provision that would allow either of the parties to request leave to file a more lengthy brief beyond 500 words. And I'm not sure if any of the working groups had considered that, and if not, perhaps that would be something that would address at least the practitioner's comments. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Michael. And I see that in the chat, Brian Beckham is noting that this was not discussed in the document subteam. And I thought previously I'd seen Jason's hand up from the practitioner subteam. Jason, please go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Julie. Jason Schaefer for the record. No, to answer that question, no, this was not specifically discussed within the practitioners, and the practitioners were also given opportunity, I believe, in this question as well. I can go back and check, but where they had ability to make comments, and none of the practitioners raised this as a possibility. I will say that this was considered fairly extensively, and as I think staff aptly captured, that everybody agreed that given the nature of the URS and the intent of what the URS is to accomplish, that we didn't feel that expanding the word limits and making it a much more robust filing was in line with the intent of the URS.
Thank you, Jason. And I don't see any further comments on that particular question of yours, Michael. So I guess we'll note it and see if we want to come back to that as an issue. And moving along, so amending the complaint in light of GDPR temp spec, and so under the provider subteam, MFSD accepts the DOE complaint, and MFSD's feedback was that complainants are not likely to file DOE complaints given the standard of proof, clear and convincing. May also be difficult to satisfy the second and third URS elements without access to the registration data before submission of the complaint and without the possibility to amend the complaint after the submission. MFSD suggests amending the URS procedure 3.3 in order to enable the complainant to modify the complaint within 2 to 3 days from the disclosure of the full registration data by the URS provider, and whose information is automatically pulled into forms complaint form once complainant enters the domain name to prevent complainant error. And then the draft recommendation from the provider subteam is for the working group to discuss whether URS Rule 3B needs to be amended in light of GDPR and DOE complaint. Working group to consider if URS procedure paragraph 3.3 should be amended to enable modification of complaint within 2 to 3 days from disclosure of the full registration data by the URS provider. And working group to consider whether to recommend that providers modify their operational rules in terms of automatically populating the complaint form using WHOIS data. And then we have the action item from the provider subteam to ask ADN DRC and form whether they accept a URS complaint if the complainant does not provide the contract details of the respondent, DOE complaint. Subteam to follow up with MFSD to request data evidence that support their claim about the difficulty in filing a DOE complaint. And these questions have indeed been sent on to the providers, as noted previously, earlier this week with responses requested by the 20th of August. The subteam, also as noted, will review those responses and provide further data as available to the working group. And I'm noting in the chat, Mary Wong, on 500-word complaint limit, practitioner survey results were split. The results included feedback from some that the word limit was too low, arbitrary and often insufficient, and should be slightly increased indeed, and this is included in the table here. And Kathy Kleiman, please go ahead.
Yeah, a statement and then a question. So the statement is, I seem to recall, it wasn't officially on the provider subteam, but I was on a number of the calls, seemed to recall the providers kind of raised some concerns about expanding the complaint kind of with broad references to the low fees, et cetera, and that it's designed to be express and limited. So I think there's something in the provider's materials as well. A question on the DOE complaints, the John Jane DOE complaints. For those who work in the UDRP world, how are you handling that there? And is there something we can benefit from either now or, over email, over the listserv of how UDRP is handling, DOE complaints? Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. Would anybody like to address Kathy's question? Anybody dealing in UDRP cases?
Yeah, Julie, this is Brian. I'm sorry, just to make this quick, I'll raise my hand. We have an FAQ we put together on the WIPO website. I'll be happy to send that around to the working group and that question of how we're dealing as a provider with, as we say, DOE complaints. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I see Michael, Scott Austin responded to Michael's comment that of the comments received, all suggested an increase would be beneficial for citation variation in cases. But before I go further, excuse me, Christine, please, Christine Durain.
Thanks. This is Christine for the transcript. You may wish to reach out to the providers in case they're not on the call or able to answer right now. The URS providers are in a little bit different situation than the UDRP providers who get to do a deficiency check. And so there's sort of like a built-in window for UDRP in which to sort of check on the identity of the respondent. URS says you're not allowed to do that. And so I think that the URS cases has had oh, it looks like Renee is putting something in the chat. That's helpful. I just wanted the group to be aware that URS is different from UDRP and how that's handled. So I think you definitely want to go back to the providers in case you aren't getting feedback from them on those things.
Thanks very much, Christine. And noted. And also noted in the chat where Michael Graham has asked chat staff to capture his comments. What staff will do is we will pull those comments out from the chat room and include them in the notes so that they can be included for discussion in the decisional phase. And just reminding everybody again that these chat room chat texts are always posted on the wiki for further reference as well. And it's Mary Wong is noting that staff has sent the follow-up questions also, yes, to the to the providers. And so, moving along to 7, SMD file, providers, subteam, most of the data in the SMD file is difficult to read and remains encoded. A suggested operational fix, again from the provider subteam, is to ask all providers to confirm whether their examiners are able to obtain the jurisdiction information of the trademark slash category of goods and services. Based on their response, working group to determine whether to propose any operational fix recommendation, e.g. providers pass SMD file to the respondent and examiner so that the key information about the underlying trademark is known, including jurisdiction, date of issue, categories of goods and services. Alternatively, is there another way to ensure examiners know this trademark information? And Greg, please. Greg Shatton.
Thanks. Greg Shatton for the record. If I recall correctly, the SMD file was used only for the limited purpose of demonstrating that a statement of use had been filed, was not intended to be the way that the examiner, you know, got all of the pertinent facts about the underlying TMCH registration. I could be wrong about that, but the whole idea that the SMD file is something that's supposed to be read and the fact that it can't be read means that there's some problem going on, seems to be a red herring or a misunderstanding of the use to which the SMD file was being put. There may be valid questions to be raised about how the SMD file is in fact supposed to be used, but raising questions about whether the SMD file is being used for a purpose for which it is not suited and is not intended and is not in fact being used seems to be kind of a waste of time. The human readable information in there that is in there is, as Mary says, quite limited and does not convey the information about the trademark. So whoever thought that it was supposed to was just wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And Kathy Kleinman, please.
Okay, the STI was wrong. That's possible. My recollection in 2009 is that we did think that the SMD file would pass to the examiners what it passed to the trademark claims notice. So information about the trademark, the jurisdiction, the date of registration, the categories of goods and services. Kind of critical information. Since there are no attachments in the URS, to the best of my knowledge, you don't attach that trademark registration, and that may be something we want to consider for modification. Very, very narrow attachments. But just wanted to give a different view that, that's why some people are so surprised at how little is actually visible from the SMD file, which is literally just the string of the trademark itself. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. And just some of the
relevant items in the chat. Susan Payne says, I believe that's correct, Greg. Mary Wong noting that the SMD files contain some basic human readable information with the rest of the information encoded. Plus one, Greg from John McElwain. And Mary Wong says, for example, the trademark itself is human readable, but the applicable NIST classification is coded. An SMD file is used by registry's registrars for validation, and as Greg noted, to demonstrate use. And there's further comments going on in the chat. And while those go on, I'm not seeing any other hands up, so I'm going to go ahead and proceed to topic seven, which is other topics. The provider subteam notes that MFSD's feedback suggests the following factors as possible deterrents to filing a U.S. complaint: limited applicability of the U.S. Not a consensus policy, the suspension remedy, complainants prefer filing a UDRP instead of having the domain name suspended through a URS without the possibility to own, control, use, or transfer the domain, stricter burden of proof. And I'll pause there because I see Phil Corwin has his hand up. Phil, please.
Julie, why don't you complete your summary, then I'll speak, okay?
Thank you very much, Phil. Will do. And then from the practitioners, there was a split regarding the adequacy of relief. Some expressed the desire for a transfer, others with a right of first refusal, and others seeking a voluntary negotiated transfer from the losing respondent to a prevailing complainant option or cancellation. The subteam did not comment on the survey results that most practitioners believe that a declaration, along with a specimen of use, including the submission of an SMD file from the TMCH, is adequate for demonstrating evidence of use. And the action item associated is from the provider subteam to follow up with MFSD to request data/evidence to support their claim in order to determine whether further deliberation on their feedback regarding factors as possible deterrents to filing a U.S. complaint is needed. And that indeed has happened. That question has gone out as of the 7th of August with responses requested by the 20th of August. And Phil Corwin, please go ahead.
Yeah, on this one, I just want to point out this is a good example of where these are policy proposals that can be brought up when we open the window for working group members to propose changes in the URS policy. Itself, our charter, as I posted in the chat room a little while ago, our charter does ask us to address the question of whether the URS should become a consensus policy applicable to legacy domains. Of course, you know, our findings on how it's being administered are relevant to that, but it's a question that goes beyond that. Our charter is not specific as to whether that decision and discussion should occur in phase one of our work or phase two. So far as the available remedies deterring use of the URS, that also is open for discussion. I'm aware that domain registrants, because of the brevity and speed of the proceeding, are concerned that URS could be used for domain hijacking. There may be a middle ground there on a permanent suspension, particularly that's simply to keep the domain from being used for ill purposes by others rather than for use by the complainant. But we can get into all of that in the decisional phase. It's just I wanted to intervene to illustrate that this is a good point to point out that the sub-teams, without clear consensus, didn't get into proposing policy changes. That's for working group members to propose if they wish to, and for the full working group to discuss. And again, if there's consensus support for a policy change, whether it's in phase one or phase two, that can be done. If there's no consensus support, then the default position is that the policy remains as is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. And George Kirikos, please.
Yeah, George Kirikos with Transcript. Yeah, I want to agree with Phil on that, that you know, this is feedback from one provider, and the providers are kind of in the business of wanting to grow their the number of complaints, and these are all extrajudicial procedures, so we should be looking for a balanced solution that reflects the feedback, not just from the provider who wants to grow their business, so to speak, but also the affected parties, both complainants and registrants. And if we look at the, you know, the final column, you know, the feedback is from the providers who have an incentive to have more extrajudicial procedures. And when it says practitioner survey, we should always keep in mind that it's, you know, more than 90% were complainants, practitioners, not practitioners that represent registrants. So there needs to be more feedback from the registrant side to make sure that we have a balanced solution. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Then moving along to the notice, section B, and the first of the topics under the notice is the receipt by, number one, receipt by registrant of the notice, and that's feedback from complainant and respondent, and the provider's sub-team notes that AD&DRC only sends the notice of complaint to respondents via emails and does not use the other two means, i.e. fax, physical mail, indicated in the URS rules. There are potential difficulties for providers to comply with U.S. rules and procedures due to the impact of GDPR. Providers reference who is data in order to communicate with as well as send the notice of complaint and the notice of default to the respondents. Providers would reference who is if the registrar does not communicate any underlying contact information of registrant when the privacy slash proxy service is used. Providers also obtain registrant's contact information provided by the complainants, registry operators, and registrars, and information shown on a registrant's websites. Nevertheless, they report that they have not received any complaint regarding not receiving notice. Form and MFSD reported that their mail, fax, and email to the respondent were not delivered sometimes. Providers are unable to use courier services to deliver mail to P.O. box addresses. Then in the third column, the draft recommendation from the document subteam that there's no additional policy work required. The provider subteam suggests that the working group could consider the impact of GDPR on providers' obligations concerning notice, and a suggested operational fix from the provider subteam would be for ADN-DRC to change their operational rules to comply with URS procedure 4.2, e.g. delivery of the notice of complaint in hard copy, is critical if a spam filter removes the electronic notices from view, and to comply with URS policy. I'll stop there and look for any hands. I'm not seeing any hands up. And I do have a hand up. George Kirikos, please.
Yeah, George Kirikos. Where it says in the preliminary findings that providers would reference who is if the registrar does not communicate any underlying contact information when the privacy proxy service is used. I think that's going to be problematic because some of the registrars are not necessarily putting proxy information. They're putting in just, you know, redacted, which doesn't really qualify as privacy or proxy. So I think we have to take a lot of care to make sure that all the who is problems that exist are considered properly when we're making our final recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And moving along, not seeing any other hands. Number two, effect on registry operator notice requirements for registry operators. And so, provider subteam, provider's feedback indicates there may be some clerical issues concerning the registry operators, including communicating from email addresses different from the contacts present in the ICANN's repository, not responsive to requests for information from URS providers, delay in sending notifications to the URS providers regarding the completion of URS actions, not completing URS actions despite notifications and reminders from the providers, resulting in a need for the providers to report noncompliance to ICANN. And
And then under the third column, suggested operational fix from the provider's sub-team working group to discuss whether issues with registry operators and locking of domains raise enforcement or compliance issues, and working group to evaluate how clerical issues can be addressed, including keeping ICANN's email addresses for registry registry contacts reached by providers up to date. And then there is a question, document subteam to the provider subteam. Is any other additional policy work required? This will depend on whether specific issues are identified for policy work from the follow-up with the three providers. And then see the action items from the provider subteam, the subteam to follow up with form and ask why GDPR may make the activation of URS lock more difficult. And the document subteam, working group to contact registry operators to obtain feedback on qualitative experiences about receiving notices from providers, e.g., were these sent through appropriate channels, and did they contain the correct information? Note, timing TBD in light of imminent issuance of Sunrise and claim surveys. So, first of all, the first of the action items, that question has been conveyed to forum with respect to the document subteam action item. That set of questions to registry operators is pending. Their responses to the Sunrise and claim surveys so as not to overburden the registry operators with multiple inquiries all at once. But those are noted as an action for staff to take. And looking for any hands and discussion on this item. And not seeing any other hands, then moving on to item three, other topics. The providers subteam, ADN-DRC did not receive information from ICANN regarding the back-end registry operator bureau point of contact. Forum receives a report from ICANN that contains this information, and MFSD receives credentials to access ICANN's repository. This information, a suggested operational fix from the provider subteam would be for the subteam to contact ICANN GDD, inquiring about the inconsistency with regard to how BRO information is relayed to the providers. Based on ICANN GDD's response, working group to consider whether any operational fix recommendation should be proposed. And this inquiry has been sent to GDD, and staff is awaiting a response, which we'll convey once received. Anything that anybody wants to raise before we move ahead? I'm not seeing any hands up. So to the response, the first topic is duration of response period. Duration of response period, including the initial 14-day period, 6 months after notice of default, including possibility of extension and 14 days to appeal. Practitioner subteam did not comment on the survey results, indicating that 8 out of 12 practitioner responses either agreed or strongly agreed. These are appropriate, with 3 disagreeing and noting they should be shorter. Provider subteam, all providers believe the response period is sufficient. Providers also grant requests for extension of time to respond. No provider has received a late response. The draft recommendation from provider and document subteams is that no additional policy work is required. And let me again see if there are any hands. I see a hand up. George Kirikos, please.
Yeah, George Kirikos. This kind of ties into the limitation period because we're seeing disputes over relatively worthless domain names that people aren't necessarily invested in. But if the URS continues in its current form, it will affect more and more valuable domain names where registrants will want to appeal because they've invested time and money into their domain name. And so obviously the trivial complaints which are indefensible aren't going to be affected by these time limits at all. But the ones where the registrant does want to defend them, 14 days I don't see as being sufficient. So if you look at the U.S. TTAB, I believe all their notice periods are 20 days. So I think that might be a guideline for what the response period should be. Alternatively, it should be based on the age of the domain name. So, for example, if you've owned a domain name for 3 months, your response period is going to be on the shorter end of the response scale response time. Whereas if you owned a domain name for 5-10 years, the response period should be longer, given that there's less urgency in having the dispute settled. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Any other comments? I see some folks are typing in the chat, which is obviously going to be captured. So moving ahead to topic two, other issues relating to responses, other than issues relating to defenses, e.g. default procedures. The document subteam reviewed the data from the cases and noted where a response was submitted. Provider subteam form an MFSD, conduct compliance check on responses for factors beyond the ones stated in the URS rule, and I'm hard to read that rule, looks like 5G. ADNDRC only flags the superficial formatting and noncompliance issue in a response. The appointed examiner screened the other noncompliance issues. And with respect, there's a draft recommendation from the document subteam on the cases where responses were filed. No additional research or work seems necessary. The action item is from the provider subteam that they would review forms appendix B and MFSD's checklist used for administrative review of the response and consider whether further deliberation is needed. And and then just we're noting George's comment in the chat as well. Anything that anybody wants to raise? Then moving to D, standard of proof. The first topic is general, and the practitioner subteam noted that most survey responses respondents reported that the decisions that slash determination provided the reasons upon which the decision was based as required by Section 13B of the U.S. rules. Practitioners believe that the RPM is being used for, quote, clear cases of abuse, close quote, as it was intended. Most thought that the standard of proof, quote, unquote, is adequate as is, quote, unquote. The draft recommendation from the document subteam, based on the data, there does not appear to be a need to modify the standard of proof for URS clear and convincing. And looking for hands and seeing none. Moving along to topic two, examiner's guide. The practitioner subteam, about half of the practitioner respondents agreed there should be more guidance provided to educate or instruct practitioners on what is needed to meet the clear and convincing burden of proof in a URS proceeding. Practitioner subteam, provider subteam, 2 out of 3 providers did not strongly support the issuance of an examiner's guide, at least to the extent that the guide is to provide direction or examples as to the distinction between clear-cut and more difficult cases. Suggested operational fix from the practitioner subteam is to recommend creating educational materials to provide more guidance to, quote, educate or instruct practitioners on what is needed to meet the clear and convincing burden of proof in a U.S. proceeding, unquote. Parties would find value in the creation of an overview for U.S. decisions like the WIPO overview on UDRP cases. And from the document subteam, although it may be useful to provide some guidance as to what constitutes clear and convincing evidence in light of the different laws around the world, the guidance would not extend to providing examiners with specific directions as to what is and is not a clear-cut case. It may be preferable to develop a guide that is more in the nature of a checklist, such as the one initially developed by the IRT as Appendix E of its report, rather than a substantive document like the WIPO UDRP overview. And I will ask if there are any comments.
Julie, this is Brian. I'm sorry to jump in on the phone one more time. Just on the idea of a jurisprudential overview like we've produced at WIPO, just want to flag for people
This was probably a work product that took well upwards of 1,500 hours. So just to give people a kind of an idea, if this is the type of thing that would be suggested, you know, it's interesting as an idea, but of course these ideas, as with everything we've been discussing, don't happen in a vacuum. So just that we have kind of our eyes on the bigger picture. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Brian. And I have two hands up. I have Kathy Kleiman and Phil Corwin. Kathy, please.
All the co-chairs coming in. Thanks, Julie. So this is one of the examples where two sub-teams were talking about the same issue from, let's say, two different perspectives. So same issue at the same time. So practitioners, I just wanted to point out that there's two different, which I was a member of. Jason was chair, but I was a member. And just wanted to point out that there are two different recommendations. One is that parties, we know from the survey that complainant and registrant attorneys in general would find some value in a creation of an overview for URS decisions. And as Brian pointed out, it's probably not going to be nearly as comprehensive. It can't be as long or comprehensive. And the providers have said they're really not in a position to provide that, if I remember correctly. But I just wanted to point out the first bullet point is actually focused on practitioners, that they're looking for more educational materials that educate and instruct them on what's needed to meet clear and convincing burden of proof. So it may not be identical to this overview for URS decisions that's being discussed. So kind of how can we deliver more materials, perhaps not even that long, or how can we help ICANN deliver more materials that would help people use the URS more and feel more comfortable using it? So different perspectives, again, from different sub-teams and different thoughts. So this is an area which might be very fruitful for the working group. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. And Phil, please.
Yeah, just a brief personal comment. One, I've already previously posted my view that the WIPO guidance is relevant to the URS in that URS is intended to be a supplement to a supplement to the URS. So to the extent that the elements that must be shown are the same, the only difference is the burden of proof and some of the timing and word limitation elements. So if that WIPO guidance is relevant to a URS case, it's already there, and I don't think there should be any argument that it can be looked at. Having said that, and consistent with what my co-chairs have said, a lot of that WIPO guidance goes to shade of gray issues, and since URS practice is only supposed to be for clear black and white cases of infringement, a lot of it may not be relevant, and if there was a separate guidance for URS practice, it would in all likelihood be much more abbreviated than what exists for UDRP. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And not seeing any other hands up, I'll move to topic three, which is other topics. Document subteam has begun reviewing the 59 cases where the respondent prevailed, i.e. the complainant's claim was denied. Analysis so far, 31 cases saw no response filed. Of the 28 cases where a response was filed, 22 of these were filed within the initial 14-day response period. The remaining cases where a de novo review occurred as the respondent filed a response after the 14-day period following a notice of default but before the six-month period expired, see Section G below. Anything anybody wants to raise on here? We have no recommendations on this, and I think that, yes, Phil, please. And I see Phil's hand.
Very old hand.
Thank you. Moving along to defenses. The first topic is scope of defenses. And the second topic, these are grouped together, is unreasonable delay in filing a complaint, i.e. lashes. There's quite a bit here to
to read. All right. Let me just confirm with the co-chairs that you do want staff to read everything to record, or perhaps staff could suggest, given that the text in column 2 is quite voluminous and people can see it here, perhaps we could go to the suggested operational fix and recommendations. Let me ask if there's any objections to that approach in the interest of time. And Phil says summarizing is fine by me. So we did have, just to summarize, we did have findings from the document subteam, the providers subteam as well, quite a large number of responses from the relating from the providers subteam. But to move ahead to the suggested recommendations column, as a suggested operational fix, the providers note that there have been determinations where either no clear rationale reasons were elaborated in the decision. Providers also vary in terms of the amount of guidance they provide their examiners and in the use of a template determination form. The working group to further examine the divergent practice and requirements of providers with regard to examiner providing reasoning in support of their determinations. Working group to deliberate on forums practice, which significantly deviates from that of ADN, DRC, and MFSD, and consider whether it raises any compliance issue. And the draft recommendation from the provider subteam is the working group to consider whether all providers should give similar type/forms of guidance to their examiners. And from the document subteam and section G, also working group to consider recommending the development of an administrative checklist or basic template of minimum elements that should go into a determination. Let me pause there and see if anybody has anything they would like to raise. I'm not seeing any hands up. And so we will move to F, remedies, and scope of remedies. And just doing a time check here. So, again, in the preliminary findings, practitioner subteam observed a split in responses regarding the adequacy of relief. Some expressed a desire for a transfer, others for the right of first refusal, and others seeking a voluntary negotiated transfer from the losing respondent to a prevailing complainant option or cancellation. And the following options were suggested in the practitioner's survey results: an out-and-out transfer to a winning party as opposed to suspension, an option of a voluntary negotiated transfer from losing respondent to prevailing complainant before domain expires. There are negotiated transfers taking place, but they're not sure how they're implemented. The subteam noted it would be interesting to look at the suggested remedies to see if they were considered in the history of the promulgation of the URS, such as a right of first refusal to purchase the domain when it becomes available and establishing process for requesting suspension renewals. The document subteam suggests that these questions be deliberated by the full working group. And so while there are no recommendations, there is that suggestion that that there could be further deliberation in the full working group. Anything anybody wants to raise? You'll see there's quite a bit of information under the section of the data source for these deliberations as well. Then moving along to the next two topics, duration of suspension period and review of implementation. And we have from the practitioner subteam, one-third of practitioners indicated problems with the implementation of the relief awarded following the URS decision, and their responses bear review. Registrars often do not respond to the request for a renewal of the suspension. Some registrars do not understand the process of paying for an additional year of suspension. In some cases, a losing respondent is able to re-register a domain once it becomes available. After the lock, the cyber squatters just renew the domain name and any problems with the Chinese registrar in order to implement the decision.
and then from the providers reporting some difficulty getting the registry and registrar on the same page to implement a settlement, which typically involves the transfer of the domain registration at the registrar level. Some registry operators did not complete suspensions despite notifications, resulting in a need to report their noncompliance to ICANN. Some delayed sending notifications to providers regarding the completion of URS suspension. Registry and registrars have difficulty implementing the extension requests of the URS suspension as they may not have understood their roles in the process. And there's some feedback from forum examiners. It was also received supporting the possibility of altering registration information during the additional year of suspension that is available to a successful complainant. And so draft recommendation from the providers is for the working group to re-examine the URS technical requirements and discuss whether URS technical requirements and registry requirement 10 should be amended. Suggested operational fix from the provider subteam. Working group to discuss whether issues with registry operators and implementation of URS decisions raise enforcement or compliance issues. Working group to discuss whether there is a need to enhance understanding by registry operators and registrars of their roles in the URS process. And in the practitioner subteam, a recommendation of an enhanced education to help registrars understand how to implement relief and gain better awareness of URS procedures. And then an action item for the subteam to contact registry operators and registrars about compliance issues. And again, as noted above, this timing is TBD in view of the Sunrise and Claims surveys that are about to be launched. Asking for any questions or comments. And I see George Kirikos. Please go ahead.
Yeah, George Kirikos here for the transcript. These things are looking at it solely from the perspective of the providers and the complainants. When we talk about compliance costs for the registrars and the registries, which are kind of implicit here, we need to really be talking to the registrars and the registries directly to understand how much costs they're incurring to comply with these. Like there's issues of they're not being in compliance, but what are the actual costs for them of complying with these procedures? Because let's say on average there's 200 or 300 URS complaints per year, which is statistically correct, I think, with 1,000 plus new GTLD top-level registries, that means on average they might see one a year, maybe two. Some will have more because they own multiple registry operators or they handle the back end for multiple TLDs. But I think when we're trying to weigh the benefits versus the costs, we need to definitely take into the costs of compliance by the registry operators and the registrars, and also obviously the registrants. But I think that's something where we should probably get some data and feedback from the registrars and who are participating on this list, and also the registry operators, because that might speak more to either streamlining the compliance or even eliminating some of these procedures entirely if the benefits just aren't there. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, George. And staff would just like to point out the action item that may address your point that there is the action item for the subteam to contact the registry operators and the registrars about these compliance issues. And that is outstanding because we don't want to overburden those groups with additional inquiries at the same time as they will be receiving inquiries based on the Sunrise and Claims surveys. And yes, we note the compliance costs, and we can note to include that as part of the inquiry. Thank you, George. And we're getting close on time here. So let me just quickly finish out this last item and then make a suggestion for how we will move forward. On other topics, providers' feedback suggests the following factors as possible deterrents to filing a U.S. complaint, limited applicability of the U.S., not a consensus policy. So some of this has been noted previously. I think there's some duplication here, but it's it is nonetheless. Yeah, I have, George, you have your hand up, and I'm just making sure that I'm in the right place here. George Kirikos, please go ahead.
Yeah, George Kirikos for the transcript. We're on page, I guess, 23, where it talks about the HSTS problem that was identified with regards to .app. And I think it says, though, to talk about the registry operators. It's really not the registry operators that need to be consulted. It's more the providers themselves who aren't implementing HTTPS secure versions of their suspension pages. And so it's really a trivial fix for them to do that. If they do any research, they can get, you know, Let's Encrypt no-cost SSL certificates. And if they have a management interface or control panel for their suspension page, they could easily have that implemented, assuming they have some technical experts working for them. So I don't think it's the registry operators that should be consulted. It's more the providers to improve their technical capabilities. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And we'll note that. And because we have only 2 minutes left here, I'm going to go ahead and pause. This we will take up where we left off on the next call. And staff would like to suggest and also then ask if the co-chairs agree that this might be a way forward is, in addition to continuing this discussion on the next call, it may be helpful to set a deadline now that folks will have had a chance to see this document and review it of, say, up till next Tuesday prior to the next call to provide suggestions on what might be missing from this document. So, you know, what is there something that the sub-team raised, that we have not included in this document, issues that had been discussed and which there was agreement in the working group that also should be included in this document. So the suggestion is that we might get that feedback and we can capture it prior to next week's call. And I'll make that suggestion. And Brian Beckham, please go ahead. And then Phil, please. Brian, if you're speaking, we're not hearing you. Still not hearing you, Brian. Phil, can you try while we're trying to see if we can get Brian?
Yes, it appears that unfortunately Brian is afflicted with technical laryngitis, which is when your telecom equipment doesn't work. I think your suggestion is a good one, Julie. I think after the call ends that staff should send out the document again with a clear notice to all working group members that we're proposing a deadline of next Tuesday, close of business next Tuesday, the 14th, for any comments on the document. And if anyone believes that based on the information developed by any of the sub-teams that we're missing a draft recommendation, a suggested operational fix, or action item, or that another question needs to be asked, they should raise it over the next week, and the notice to members should also emphasize that this document does not limit the scope of what members can propose for, you know, beyond the sub-team work in terms of any of those, as well as, of course, policy changes. So if you're a registrant and you think that the policy should be changed to have a latches provision, for example, or if you're a potential complainant, a trademark owner, and you think that the remedy should be expanded to permanent suspension or domain transfer, there's no deadline to raise that by next Tuesday. Those suggestions will be in order when we open the period for members to propose changes, and the co-chairs will have to discuss among themselves and come back to the working group for ratification on how that process will work. But we'd like to get this document finalized as the basis for further action and consideration by the sub-team within the next week. So I'll stop there and see if any of my co-chairs, if Brian is able to communicate now, or if Kathy has comments, or any other working group member. We're 1 minute past, but I think that's a good way to go to stay on our timeline while being fair to everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And Brian, are we able to hear you at this point? Not hearing Brian. Kathy, please. Kathy Kleinman.
So just seconding what Phil said, Phil, I think you've blazed a path forward. Let me see if I can summarize it, that next week we'll be finishing this document as it is, but meanwhile, including pages 24 to 36 that we haven't covered today, 1 through 36, we'd like everyone in the working group to review it from your perspective as a sub-team member, from your perspective as a working group member, see if anything's missing from it in terms of what the sub-teams have done to make this the super consolidated document we think it is, but that there'll be a later period when we're talking about larger policy issues or policy issues that may be kind of aside and outside of this data-driven analysis, that we'll have another time frame for that. So 1 week for this document as a review of the sub-team work. Completely agree if that's an accurate summary. And great thanks to Julie for a heroic effort getting us through most of this.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Thank you, everyone. And we'll go ahead and close this call as we are 3 minutes after the hour. Thank you for staying on a little bit longer. We appreciate it. And we'll look forward to talking to you next week. You'll see some action items coming out a little bit later today. Thank you.